And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
As an old journalist, I may be biased, but I believe with every fiber of my soul that journalism at its best is fundamental to a strong, functioning democracy. We can't rely solely on government or powerful institutions for absolute candor or even at times for the truth that citizens need and deserve to help make informed decisions. That's why I so admire Bart Gellman of The Atlantic, a brilliant writer, probing reporter, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's for decades penetrated the veil of secrecy that too often hangs over Washington. He shocked many with a piece in September 2020 forecasting Donald Trump's feverish attempts to overturn the election, a piece that, in the rereading, appears eerily prophetic, and he recently published a sequel entitled Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun. We sat down this week to talk about his reporting and the imminent threats to our democracy. Here's that conversation. Bart Gellman, it's good to see you. Happy New Year to you. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. I've been a fan of the show for a long time.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, I've been a fan of yours, and I'm going to say what I say behind your back, which is journalism is so essential to democracy because it's how we shine bright lights into dark corners and give people some sense of what's going on in their own government. I mean, that's one of the major functions. Nobody does it better than you, and we've got a lot to talk about in that regard. But how one becomes a preeminent investigative journalist in America is an investigation I want to pursue right now for a few minutes here and ask you a little bit about yourself and your upbringing. You're from the Philadelphia area.
That's right.
And tell me about your folks, because I read all this interesting stuff about, well, both of them, but your dad in particular, that made me think, aha, maybe this is how Gellman started getting interested in journalism.
Well, my dad started off as a journalist. He worked for the old Evening Bulletin in Philadelphia, which was the afternoon paper that long since ceased to exist. He walked away from journalism into public relations and started up his own little firm. He liked working for himself. I remember one of my childhood memories is him taking a sledgehammer to the wall between the basement and the garage as he was creating a little office in there.
I thought you were going to say as he got off the phone from a client who was really pissing him off. Did he inculcate you with a kind of interest in journalism and news? Was that something that was prevalent in your home? I know your mom was a school teacher.
My mom was a school teacher. She was a music teacher, and she was actually the one who was more involved in the news of the day and the political news. She ran for and was elected a local committee woman at one point.
Ah.
Talked about the news of the day with us, and just interested in the wider world.
You obviously took to journalism because you became the editor of your high school newspaper. And I raise this not as a trivial matter, but there was a huge controversy surrounding your editorship of that paper that sort of, I think, set the terms of your relationship with institutions for the rest of your life. But you talk about that and how you came to end up suing your school over their censorship of your publication.
So you've been doing your research, I see.
I'm eager to see the pieces. But anyway, go ahead.
It was for a long time just sort of a rah-rah school rag, the school paper, and I was interested in an upgrade, I guess. This is all on account of having to try something new after I washed out of the gymnastics team. I was really quite a bad gymnast, it turned out. So I joined the paper, I became editor of the paper, and found out about a summer internship or a summer enrichment program at Columbia Journalism School for high school students, and went to that and came back all filled with ambition and dreams of the First Amendment and a desire to shake things up. So we did a deliberately provocative three-part series in the paper about teenage pregnancy and the phenomenon at our own school, which the principal was not fond of. And she warned us not to publish it. But I had spent the whole summer before that school year selling ads so that we were independent. And I purposely moved it to an outside printer so it wasn't printed in the school anymore, thinking, haha, that will make me immune from the principal's objections. She just sent an administrative aide over to the printer and seized all the papers and burned them.
This is good preparation for covering autocracy. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no autocrat greater than an angry high school principal. And her name was almost from a movie. Her name was Wacker, Dr. Wacker. in any case, she fired me as the editor and locked me out of the office and literally burned all the papers. And my co-editors and I brought a First Amendment lawsuit in federal court. This is at a time when the big precedent was a case called Tinker against Des Moines, which said that the Constitution doesn't end at the schoolhouse gate. And we were filled with youthful outrage. And
and there's nothing quite like that.
But, nothing quite like that. Yeah. That's the force against the high school principal. In any case, we ended up learning a lesson in humility, because lawsuits take a long time. And my senior year progressed, and college applications came, and graduation came, and the case was still in the courts. And we ended up winning a favorable settlement when I was partway into my freshman year of college. Which said we could publish the stories, but the principal had waited us out. We were all gone. The new editor, who would have been appointed by the principal, had no interest in publishing the story. So she had run out the clock very successfully, and she understood the power relationship much better than we did. Yeah. It was a lesson to me. I mean, I've become interested in power and its use and abuse over the years, in large part because of that. I mean, I was lucky enough to have something happen to me young that forced me to think hard about what I cared about, and definitely pushed me in the direction of journalism.
You went to Princeton, and you didn't study journalism. You did journalism there, but you didn't study journalism. Did you know you were going to be a journalist?
Yeah, it was my default from then on. I mean, I knew I was going to join the college paper. And I eventually became the editor of the college paper. And every summer I spent doing internships. I spent time. And the great thing about journalism internships is you can be 19 or 20 or 21 and a student just there for a couple of months, and you're still writing byline stories. And if you write a good enough story, it might end up on the front page. So I worked for the Miami Herald and New Republic and National Journal, and I learned from professionals sitting among them in the newsroom.
I mean, I don't want to debase journalism schools in any way. I think journalism is one of those things that you learn best by doing and being among people who do it. Those internships were formative for me as well. As I mentioned, you didn't study journalism at college. You practiced it. You studied politics and government, and you in the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. You went off and got a Rhodes Scholarship. You earned your master's degree in politics at Oxford, but all in service of writing.
It really was. The subject I chose for my master's thesis was secrecy and national security. And that has been a professional preoccupation of mine ever since. And I did a lot of hard thinking about when it's appropriate to keep secrets and when it's not, and why it's appropriate for journalists to try to find out things, even classified things, and write about them.
And you went to work for the Washington Post in 1988 covered the courts for a while. I think you covered Marion Barry's trial, the former, or I guess he was then mayor when he was on trial, wasn't he?
He was the mayor. That was a wild ride, that trial.
Yeah.
It had everything. It had sex and drugs and missing the rock and roll.
I presume that this was sort of the apprenticeship that the Post had in mind before they moved you into the national security realm, but you covered the Gulf War and then you moved to Jerusalem, and you were the Jerusalem correspondent for the Washington Post. And I raise that because you were there at a really, really historically important time when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated in the midst of trying to promote peace with the Palestinians. They had signed this Oslo Accord, which was a really breakthrough agreement. And he was assassinated by a young right-wing extremist who was opposed to the peace process. Talk about that. I mean, I remember it so clearly, and I have a specific reason I wanted to talk to you about, but talk to you about your memories of that, and how momentous was that?
Well, it's so interesting. It shows the danger of life as a foreign correspondent. I mean, the danger of screwing up your journalistic instincts. When you first get to a place, you're overwhelmed by how little you know, how you're trying to explain a foreign world to your readers while you're still trying to make some sense out of it. And after about a year, you start to think, oh, I get this place. I understand. And that's the most dangerous moment because you don't fully get it yet. And the assassination came, if I'm not mistaken, from memory, actually in 95. And I'd been there for a year, and the right-wing settlers who were opposed to the peace process were talking all the time about how there was going to be blood in the streets and civil war, and there's an expression in Hebrew that, you know, it's a revolution earthquake, and it's all so overwrought that I started thinking of it all as not meaningful. It was just symbolic. And then someone comes along and sneaks up behind the prime minister and shoots three shots into his back, and you realize, oh, they really meant it. In fact, I had interviewed the assassin, Yigal Amir, before the assassination. I had found him at a settlement in the West Bank, and he talked to me about how the government was filled with traitors and had to be stopped. And again, I just saw this all as sort of empty rhetoric, and my spider sense didn't tingle at all. I didn't know that this guy already, when we were talking, had been stalking Rabin, had twice gone to places where he hoped to find a shot at him, and had not yet succeeded. I found the notebook afterward on the night of the assassination and was chilled to read those words.
The reason I raise it is twofold. One is the impact of political violence on a democracy, and the notion in the minds of those who commit the violence that somehow that violence is legitimated by their commitment, to the to in this case to, it was to Israel, But you know that that is one element of this. The other is just how the act of one deranged person can change the course of history so profoundly. And I wanted to ask you whether you thought what you thought would have happened had Rabin lived, because after he died, Shimon Peres became prime minister of Israel, and he was defeated by Bibi Netanyahu, and that effectively ended the process that began in Oslo. Tell me what you think would have happened had Rabin survived. Would the course of the Middle East have changed?
It's so hard to know these counterfactuals, but I think that although the great man theory of history is often criticized, the loss of one man here did profoundly shift the course of events. There was a moment in history when both the Israelis and Palestinians were prepared by slim majorities to accept half a loaf. They were prepared finally to reach a political settlement with the Oslo Accords and the progress toward peace. And they had this very strong, tough leader mm-hmm. who had been associated all his career with military prowess and with crackdowns against terrorists, and had famously said during some of the earlier uprisings, you've got to break their arms, break their legs, show them who's boss. And now he was the one who was ready to make peace, and he was carrying the Israeli people along with him. He had a clear majority and a very strong and passionate minority that thought he was selling out the country. And if he had lived, I think there was a real chance that there could have been by now a side-by-side states sharing that space in the Middle East.
Whenever I think of that, I think when you and I were kids, Robert Kennedy's assassination and how that might have changed the course of history, because he well may have been the nominee in 1968 here in the U.S., I think had a good chance to defeat Nixon. Probably would have ended the Vietnam War much sooner. No Watergate, I mean, it is stunning to think how these acts can change history. You came back to the Post, to the States for the Post, covered Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, covered efforts to disarm Iraq, early efforts to disarm Iraq. And then you moved to New York to do special projects. And you were in New York on 9/11. You were out on the streets and you were covering. Tell me about that experience, because that also is a formative experience in your trajectory.
It was. It was momentous for me, as it was for so many millions of others. I was sitting in my New York apartment, and I had to find out that a plane had hit the World Trade Center from my editor, who called me up and said, a plane's just hit the World Trade Center. You better go find out what's going on down there. And at first, it was going to be a terrible plane crash story. I grabbed a notebook and a water bottle and camera, I think, and this had become, sort of rushing toward disaster had become a familiar instinct in the Jerusalem job, where I'd covered so many terrorist attacks. And I started trying to head downtown, and I thought to myself, well, how do I want to move in the city right now? I'm 7 or 8 miles uptown of where the thing just happened. I decided I did not want to get on the subway because I was afraid I'd get caught down there.
Yeah.
and stuck. I grabbed a cab, and cab said, "I'm not driving down to a plane crash." But I said, "Just go down as far as you're willing to go." Then I got out and literally just took all the bills out of my wallet and started waving them at drivers to see who would drive me a little further. And when that stopped working, I'm still too far away. And I stood in the middle of the street and I flagged down a motorcycle. I held up my press card as though that somehow gave me authority. And I asked this great big, huge bearded guy, would you take me down that way? If you're going that way, would you take me down there? And he was going because he was a tourist and he wanted to go snap pictures. That was fine with me. So I finally made my way down to the scene. By that time, one of the towers was gone. And my mind, I hadn't heard the news while I was driving down. My mind couldn't cope with the idea that one of the towers was gone. I saw a burning tower, and I thought the other one must be, from my perspective, behind it. I didn't understand what was going on, and I finally got within a few blocks. And while I watched, the second tower crumbled.
Did you realize at that moment, did you say to yourself, this is a terrorist attack?
Oh, yeah. As soon as I saw that it was both buildings, that's no coincidence. And I had been covering national security. I was well aware of Al-Qaeda, which 3 years before had done coordinated attacks against American embassies in Africa. And I assumed, as most U.S. government intelligence analysts assumed right away, that it was an Al-Qaeda operation.
And how did that shift your focus? Because you very much began covering the war that followed. And, you know, this very much led you into that, your fundamental focus about secrecy, national security, the whole WMD story. Talk a little bit about where, how your life changed the day those buildings went down.
Well, you know, I'd been in the middle of a long project on bail bondsmen and bounty hunters, which was interesting, and I never came back to it. I never wrote this series. I moved immediately to covering what George W. Bush had just declared as a war on terrorism. And my first question that I worked out with my editors was, if there's a war on terrorism, what did it look like before 9/11? What did it look like before the planes hit the Pentagon and went down in Pennsylvania and hit the World Trade Center? And it turned out there had been a behind-the-scenes quiet war that was little known, primarily taking place in secret spaces and in the intelligence world and the world of special operations, that had been going on all the way through the Clinton administration. And so I was looking at what was the war in the couple of years before 9/11 and in the first 8 or 9 months of the Bush presidency. What was Bush doing then and what were his people doing? And it was it turned up a lot of evidence that they had not done enough.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show.
And then came the war in Iraq, first Afghanistan, but then Iraq. That was predicated on the allegation that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and that it was essential to get them. Were you suspicious of that claim? And what did you learn about sort of how did your understanding of secrecy in national security, how was that burnished by your experience in examining that issue and in covering the war itself?
Well, the biggest lesson for me was that empirical facts really matter in journalism. And it's fine to have instincts, but it's really important to be open to evidence and find out that your instincts aren't true. Because I had covered the weapons of mass destruction debate in about Iraq long before 9/11. back in the 90s, around the time of the first Gulf War, when the UN Commission, then known as UNSCOM, was convinced that Iraq had undeclared stocks of chemical and biological weapons and missile programs. So when the momentum began toward war with Iraq, I believed it was likely that Iraq did in fact still have weapons of mass destruction. What I credit myself with is doing the reporting and the observations and the hard journalistic work of convincing myself and finding out that those suspicions were not true.
Do you think the administration knew that the suspicions were untrue? I mean, did we go to war on a false premise?
I think the answer is mixed on that one. As for biological and chemical weapons, it was almost consensus in the intelligence community and among many of America's allies that Iraq still had explaining to do, that it probably still had undeclared stocks of things like mustard and possibly even the advanced mm-hmm. nerve agent VX. There were legitimate suspicions about that. The nuclear program, however, had been completely dismantled after the first Gulf War, and there was almost no evidence that Iraq had an ongoing nuclear weapons program or nuclear enrichment of uranium. It had no plutonium program. And there was good evidence, which I turned up, that was all classified, that the Iraqi program was dead. And because nuclear weapons have such a fearsome emotional impact, the idea of a mushroom cloud became the Bush administration's big selling point for a war against Iraq. They claimed completely falsely that there was evidence of an Iraqi nuclear program, and this was driven primarily by Dick Cheney,
who you wrote extensively about, including a book. Why did you focus so intensely on Cheney?
Because I care about power and accountability for those in power, and Cheney was this irresistible target because everyone understood that he was a very powerful vice president, probably the most powerful vice president we've ever had in terms of influence on policy, and yet he was by far the most secretive person in government, the most secretive vice president we'd ever had. He liked working behind the scenes. He liked working so you don't even see what he's doing. And that was an irresistible target. And it was also a little bit of a daunting target because everything was so well hidden with Cheney, and it was so hard to penetrate what was happening in that office. So I actually resisted doing a long-term project on Cheney at first. I thought it might be too hard to get. And Len Downey, the executive editor of the Washington Post at the time, sat me down one day and said, "We really need you to do this. This is in your wheelhouse. This guy's important. We aren't penetrating. You're our best shot at this. We're going to team you up with Joe Becker, and you're going to set off in earnest." And I said, "Okay, boss."
What were your thoughts when Dick Cheney walked out on the floor of the House with his daughter Liz, who's leading the charge in many ways against Trump's incursions on democracy? And there's Dick Cheney, who was the bete noire of Democrats throughout his tenure as vice president, Darth Vader. And he's surrounded by Nancy Pelosi and others. You must have had some complicated feelings about that.
It was quite a sight. It was remarkable to see the embrace of the Democratic establishment for a guy who had been truly the villain in their narrative of the world for so many years, and a guy who was just clearly responsible for some of the morally most damaging policies, including torture, and who had been a principal driver of the greatest strategic mistake of arguably any president in a long time, which was the Iraq War. But one of the themes of my book on Dick Cheney is that he was a true believer. He was prepared to lie if necessary, as he thought it, to get his way to in the world. But he believed in the worldview that he espoused, and he believed in the Constitution as he read it. And he was a zealot on those things. And when Trump came along and took control of the Republican Party, and all of the Republican establishment wound up bowing down before him, the Cheneys did not, because they are true believers. And fortunately for us, one of their true beliefs is that the American constitutional system of alternating in power and peaceful transfer of power and honoring elections was part of their worldview.
You don't see inconsistency, and I'm not suggesting there is, between him being on the floor at that memorial service on January 6th and his robust tactics as vice president and penchant for secrecy.
I think it was all of a piece. I mean, he was a Republican partisan as much as anyone, and played hardball, absolutely played hardball, you know, as much or more than Mitch McConnell. But he does have certain principles, certain core beliefs, and he loathes Trump and all the Trumpism stands for. And although he didn't say much about that during the Trump years in power, he let it be known that he was not on that team. And when push came to shove, and we had January 6th, and we had an actual attempt by an American president to overthrow an election and prevent the peaceful transfer of power, Cheney knew where he stood and was willing to say so.
I just have to ask you about one other a very intriguing figure with whom you were associated professionally, and that is Edward Snowden. You were the reporter who was the recipient. You were approached about handling the material that he stole really from the NSA that revealed this vast apparatus to collect data about Americans and others around the world. But tell me just very briefly about that experience and about Snowden and how you feel about I mean, there are people who you probably respect and know who say, look, the guy did tremendous damage to this country, outed intelligence operations around the world, put people in jeopardy, Americans and others. And there are others who say he is a hero. Talk to me about Edward Snowden and your experience with him.
This was like my graduate thesis come to life. This was direct conflict between national security secrecy with legitimate secrets in some cases, and the ability of a self-governing people in democracy to hold their own government to account. The question is, can the government hold secrets from the people about the way it's spying on them? Can the government spy on its citizens without telling them that this is something they regard as essential for security? Now, the national security establishment, the National Security Agency, I thought were sincere in their belief that they needed all these programs in order to safeguard the American people, but they weren't telling us. I believed that it was simply not tolerable in a democracy to have the government spying on the people without informed consent. And so I thought there were a great many things in the Snowden documents, and he gave me tens of thousands of documents There were many things in there that the American people had to know, had to be told. I also thought there were many things in there that should not be disclosed, and I did not disclose them. And I kept, I took enormous precautions so that the documents would not leak. But I have no doubt there was some damage done. I think in a democracy, you know, JFK did not say, we will make no sacrifice and bear no cost in defense of liberty. He said the opposite. Sometimes you have to accept trade-offs between security and self-government, and this was one of those times.
You must have had some really interesting conversations with the government. You and Marty Baron, the editor of the Washington Post, who of Spotlight fame, probably the best guy to have in your corner in those situations. But what were those conversations like?
You know, they varied from civil adult conversations in which there would be some senior member of the government who would say, we understand why you think this is newsworthy, and we understand that we can't stop you from publishing any of it. But we especially care about this and this and this. And blowing those secrets would be enormously damaging for these reasons. And even there were times when a government official, and this is not unique in my career, there were times when an official would tell me something that I did not know off the record to explain why I should not publish something that I did know. And there were times when that was very persuasive, when I said, oh, well, if those are the stakes, then I understand perfectly why that should not be published. There were also sometimes very angry conversations where, you know, in some of these stories, the government would say, you know, I'm not going to confirm or deny that this is true. If it is true and you publish it, we're going to report that potential crime to the Justice Department and go to hell. It was emotional on both sides.
There must have been moments of self-doubt on your part. Did you lay awake at night questioning yourself about where the line should be?
This was by far the most stressful time in my career as a journalist. I questioned myself all the time. I did worry a lot that I would accidentally expose some secret that had consequences I couldn't imagine. There clearly were lives at stake in some cases. I mean, I had the identities and photographs of clandestine agents who were doing very dangerous work for the NSA around the world, positioning listening devices, and I would never have considered publishing those. And yet, at the same time, the U.S. government was tracking the telephone calls of every single American, you know, local, national, and international calls, and drawing a gigantic social network of all of our connections with one another. And that was simply unacceptable. That was simply completely out of bounds, as I understood any theory of democracy, to do that without telling us.
You are married to a fine journalist in her own right, Daphna Linzer, who you met, I think, working together on stories.
On WMD, in fact, yes.
And you have four kids. Were there times when you worried that you might be held criminally responsible and that you might be prosecuted and jailed for this?
What the lawyers told me was that no journalist had ever been prosecuted up until that time for finding out a national security secret and publishing it, and that there was a relatively low probability, but not zero probability, risk of criminal prosecution. What was much more likely was that in the course of prosecuting Snowden, that the government would demand that I testify and turn over documents, and that if I did not cooperate, and I had made the decision I would not cooperate, that I could be held in contempt of court and put in jail until I complied. That, we thought, was much more probable, and I worried a lot about that.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show.
So let's talk about where we are today. So you went to work at The Atlantic in 2020, and the premise when they hired you was that you were going to focus on the policymaking around the pandemic, in part because you had done quite a bit of reporting in the early 2000s on AIDS and policymaking around that. And so I'm sure that was part of their thing, but you very quickly gravitated to another story, which is around concerns that you've now famously raised about Trump and democracy. What caused you to gravitate to that story? Was there a particular moment when you said, hey, this is the story I have to write?
I came with the full intention of delving into the pandemic and delving into the national and global policymaking around the pandemic, which was a mess. And I don't know, I had one of these instincts that I was missing the bigger story. In fact, I remember noticing that COVID was going to play a role in the election, that there would have to be changes made in the manner of conducting the presidential election because of the pandemic. And I came to see that that was going to be used as an excuse for voter suppression and hijinks in the rules of elections. And it just became clear to me that the threat to our democracy was the much bigger story right now, and one that I was positioned to work on. And I had conversations with Jeff Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, in which we agreed I was going to shift gears and focus full time on the threat to democracy.
You know, we all heard Trump for months before the election talk about the fact that the election would be rigged, that it would be fraudulent. In fact, I wanted to read something to you that I think was sort of telling, which is a quote that Leslie Stahl from 60 Minutes ascribed to Trump before he took office in 2016. You're nodding your head, so you're familiar with it. And she asked him why he's always attacking the press. And he said, you know why I do it? I do it to discredit you all and demean you all. So when you write negative stories about me, no one will believe you. In a sense, he took the same approach to the election, that either he was going to win or he was going to discredit the election so no one would believe, or at least his supporters would not believe the results. And he started that project well before the election. But no one, sounded the alarm as loudly as you did. You wrote a piece on September 23rd of 2020, and part of what you said was the worst case However, and this is before the election, it's not that Trump rejects the election outcome. The worst case is that he uses his power to prevent a decisive outcome against him. If Trump sheds all restraint and if his Republican allies play the parts he assigns them, he could obstruct the emergence of a legally unambiguous victory for Biden in the Electoral College and then in Congress. He could prevent the formation of consensus about whether there's any outcome at all. He could seize on that uncertainty to hold on to power. I mean, in retrospect, that was prescient. At the time, I think there were those who said, well, this seems overwrought.
Yeah, there were people who thought that I was spinning out doomsday scenarios that weren't justified. And I hoped that they were right. I didn't think so. But this was really unusual work for me. Nothing in my career prepared me to write about the future as much as I did in that piece, forecasting, because it's not empirical. There's no way to know for sure. But what I saw was potential. What we all saw openly from Trump was the clear statement before the election, even at the nominating convention for the Republican Party, that there is no way that I could lose the election unless there's cheating. The only outcome is that that I win. The American people will choose me. If they don't, it means the election was rigged. And that's an extraordinary thing for any politician to say, let alone a sitting president. And I came to believe that under no circumstances, literally under no circumstances, would Trump concede defeat if Biden won. And then I decided to do a lot of reporting around what would it mean to have a president who refuses to concede defeat in an election? What could he do if he pulled out all the stops? And I walked through those scenarios, having done a lot of digging with constitutional scholars and political experts who could tell me, well, he could try to cause the state legislatures in close swing states that Biden wins, and that those legislatures are controlled by Republicans. He could try to persuade those state houses to appoint electors for Trump, even though Biden had won the votes in that state. And I found found senior Republicans in Pennsylvania who were even willing to talk to me about that scenario as something that they'd considered. And so it was basically starting with a known proposition that Trump is not going to concede, and drawing out what were the implications.
You've since written another piece that in December, and its title was Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun. You cite what we now all see. I think I saw a poll today that had 72-73% of Republicans saying Biden did not win legitimately. That has taken root. One of the interesting things in your piece was some research that was done by a colleague of mine at the University of Chicago, Robert Pape, about the people who participated in the insurrection at the Capitol. And it was surprising because it wasn't the roster just of Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, but a lot of sort of everyday Americans who came to believe what Trump was telling them. And I thought of you because of all the work you had done on terrorism, on the process of it, and of radicalization. These people were radicalized by Trump to believe that their patriotic duty was to be at that Capitol and stop that count.
Well, that's exactly right. And they did not look like domestic extremists of years past. I mean, for many years, and this pattern holds true all around the world. It holds true in East Timor and the Mideast, as well as in the United States. Political violence is conducted by young men in their 20s, of low education and high unemployment. That's the typical profile, and it's been true for a long time all around the world. And if you look at the January 6th insurgents and those who, now more than 700 people who have been arrested for those crimes, their median age is 42, which is crazy, completely out of sync with precedent. They are middle class, employed, educated, white collar, and many of them are business owners. Some of them have been government officials. Some of them have been members of the military. Only one in seven are affiliated with an extremist group like the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers or the Three Percenters, but they sympathize. And the catastrophe of Trump is that he has persuaded for real 2/3 to 3/4 of all Republicans that an American election was stolen, that there is a man who is in the White House by fraud. He's an imposter. He is not the person who the American people voted for. And that is, of course, entirely made up and nonsense and disproved. Every scrap of so-called evidence that Trump and his people put forward for this proposition has been disproved, but the volume of propaganda and the closed world of propaganda that that is informing these Republican voters has turned them against their own constitutional political system.
And when you believe something like that, it does legitimate extreme actions. 40% of Republicans in a post poll just recently said that armed resistance to the government may be necessary in the future.
There are, well, that's interesting. Pape found he tried to ask the question more and more sharply as time went on to try to discount for people who were just big talkers who thought it might one day be acceptable to use violence. And he finally found that there were the equivalent of 21 million Americans who believed both that Biden was an illegitimate president and that the use of force right now is justified to restore Trump to power. And that's a lot of people.
You know, I had on the podcast last week, Representative Raskin, Jamie Raskin, who said, you know, political scientists tell us that the predicate for a successful coup is an unsuccessful coup, because the coup plotters can have a chance to examine where the weaknesses are in their efforts and do something about them. In your piece, you suggest that's exactly what Trump is up to. And we saw a piece in the Post the other day about 163 people running for offices that have to do with election administration who believe the big lie about the last election. You believe, as the title of your piece suggests, that that is exactly what Trump and his supporters are up to.
Well, that's right. There's no single referee in an American presidential election, which surprises people when they find out. I mean, normally you would think there's a winner and a loser. Somebody gets to declare that and the loser goes home. But our system is complicated and decentralized. And so there are a lot of people who have a say in who won and who lost as part of their authority. And the Trump operation and those who sympathize with him have gone around systematically and looked at every place in the system that thwarted Trump in his first attempt to overthrow an election. Every Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, every Michigan appointed commission member who said, no, we're not changing the results. Yes, Biden won. Around the country, and are systematically pulling them out by their roots, and they are driving them out of office, or they are running big lie candidates to defeat them at the next election, or they are changing the law so that those people no longer have the power to certify an election. They are trying to fix the counting of the votes next time. So that if voter suppression doesn't work and if accusations of cheating don't work, that the people in charge of doing the actual counting in enough swing states will be loyal to Trump and prepared to put their thumb on the scale.
You've said that you didn't think that people were taking this threat seriously enough. You heard the president's speech this week in Atlanta. And it kind of conflates a number of things. Some of it is these issues that you're raising. Some of it has to do with voter suppression and voting rights. What would taking it seriously look like?
Well, one thing it would look like would be the president using the bully pulpit consistently to show that his first priority right now and into the months ahead is going to be addressing this threat to democracy. He said in July in Philadelphia that the Republican efforts to subvert election machinery was the greatest threat to democracy since the Civil War. That's very strong words, but he then went silent on the subject for the next 4, 5, 6 months. And he came back yesterday with a very strong speech. He's given 60 speeches solely about COVID. He's given 40 about Build Back Better and the infrastructure bill. He's given 2 so far on democracy.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that partly because that's what people are struggling with right now, the economy, and this virus, and that's front and center in their lives. I mean, that's part of the nature of politics. But beyond the speeches, what do you think should be done? Because I'm wrestling with this. He's got this quandary. You know, he's got a Senate with a filibuster rule. What should be done?
So it's a huge question, and it's a legitimate question, and it's the logical question to ask a guy who has written that there's a profound threat to democracy in this country. And it's not really my role. I mean, thank God for the country that I'm not in charge of problem solving, because no one elected me to that, and I wouldn't be any better at that than anyone else you picked off the street. I do think that small d Democrats have to pay as much attention to the levers of power in election administration as the Republicans are now paying. They are making it a driving, organizing force to take over this machinery. And right now, Democrats are standing by and watching it with sort of jaws hanging open and not, by and large, doing very much about it. But I do know that any president as experienced as Biden knows what it looks like when a president has decided to marshal his resources and his administration in service of a grave threat to democracy, the gravest since the Civil War. They will know how to find other things to do about it, if that's in fact the way they're treating it.
I say this to you as someone who's been on the inside of the White House. You'd be surprised about the limitations. You know, we all think about the power of the presidency. When you're there, you become very aware of the limitations of it, particularly in a deeply divided country. One of the issues is the more he leans in, the more it serves Trump's project and his acolytes' project of depicting all these efforts as partisan. That essentially, you know, Trump, he promotes a Hunger Games view of the universe, of the world, where, you know, nothing's on the legit. So it's a very challenging thing. But there is one thing that is in your expertise and wheelhouse, and that is what the Justice Department is doing. Do you think that, I mean, you heard what Merrick Garland said, that they're proceeding in a responsible way here, and of going to follow the trail. Do you think the Justice Department is doing enough?
Well, this reminds me of the point that Jamie Raskin made, that the gravest danger sign of a successful coup is a prior failed coup. And that is especially true if the failed coup goes unpunished. If all we get out of January 6th, and it's not just January 6th. I mean, January 6th was a catastrophe and was a singular event of a violent sacking of the Capitol and an attempt by force to prevent the certification of a presidential election. But it was part of and an integral part of a systematic campaign to overthrow the vote. And no one has been held accountable for that. It can't be that no crime is committed when a group of people at the very top of the American government conspire to prevent the lawfully elected president from taking power. And as far as we know from any public hint, the Justice Department is not doing anything about that. Now, there may be some secret grand jury and an exceptionally well-kept secret investigation of Trump and his top lieutenants for the attempt to overthrow the results of an election. But I tend to think we would have heard something about it. And in fact, that there would have been, for example, conflicts erupting between the Justice Department investigation and the congressional investigation, because there are people who want to take the fifth before Congress, and that could be cured by giving them immunity. And normally the Justice Department, if it was doing an investigation, would have strong views about whether to give somebody immunity or not. We're not hearing of that kind of conflict, and I fear that Merrick Garland has not taken accountability for what happened in the last election seriously enough on a criminal basis.
You mentioned Pape's research and your deep research, and everyone should read this piece, Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun, because you reported broadly and spoke to a lot of people who really animate this Pape's research in some ways. How do you think those people would react, and the 40% who say they may have to take up arms? What would it look like if, in fact, Trump were indicted?
Well, that's a huge question. That would be a huge event in American history. You could look at this 40% as dry kindling. They are angry. They are convinced. And this is, by the way, in counterpoint to the bulk of Republican elected officials who know perfectly well that Biden won the election.
Yes.
But their supporters don't. The people I was talking to were the true believers who would bet their lives that the election had been stolen. And they're waiting for a spark, this massive dry kindling, and they will know what to do the next time Trump summons them. If he's indicted,
that's kind of a blowtorch, isn't it?
Yeah, it's scary.
Did you think that is something that Garland should or is considering? Should be or is considering what the impact of such an indictment would be?
Well, there was a really interesting debate before Biden took office between two very smart people, Jack Goldsmith and Bob Bauer.
Yes.
About whether it was a good idea or not a good idea to hold Trump accountable for his crimes with an indictment. Goldsmith's argument, although he believes Trump...
he was in the Justice Department in the Bush administration. Bob Bauer was the White House counsel for Barack Obama.
Exactly. And they did a book together. The Goldsmith argument was, don't indict Trump because, first of all, the way he operates like a mafia don, the evidence is always going to be indirect and circumstantial, and the cases are going to be relatively hard to prove. The political turmoil it would create is too great. It would overwhelm the entire Biden presidency. It would suck all the oxygen out of everything else that Biden wants to do.
What was Bauer's response?
Bauer's response was that it is unacceptable to allow so many grave crimes to go unpunished, that it promotes the idea that the president actually is above the law. And that we can't afford as a country to let him get away with it.
Just to finish, you're on this beat now, clearly. Are you continuing to do reporting on this story? Are you going to write a book about it? What can we expect from you in the coming months?
I have no book plans, but I am going to stay with this theme, with the threat to democracy. And I would imagine that there will be a number of individual stories, and quite likely a part three, if you conceive of the September 2020 piece and the December 2021 piece as sort of parts one and two. There'll be another big picture look at that, probably around the time of the midterm elections.
When I called you about doing this podcast, I told you that you had scared the hell out of me, so I can scarcely wait for your next piece. But I'm really grateful that you're on the beat, and for all the work that you've done. As I said, journalism, a big part of journalism is to shine a bright light in dark corners. You've done that so well on so many important issues with, I think, a great sense of responsibility. So congratulations on that, and thank you for your work and for sitting with me now.
Oh, well, thank you for a remarkably good set of podcasts that I think that you're in the very tip-top handful of interviewers on the planet. Even guests of yours who I've heard many times elsewhere always shed some new light when they talk to you. So keep up yours.
Thanks, Bart. I appreciate that. And we will stay in close touch.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.